Martin stole my line, I must say, because I was going to start by saying this conference in Warsaw is a dream come true, and it is. So over the past 3 years, the annual Humanity in Action Conference, which has taken place in Amsterdam, Berlin, and Sarajevo, at each time we considered where to hold the conference the next year, and Monica and Magda said, go east. And now we are here in this vibrant country and in the city. And we will probe into fascinating aspects of Polish history in the 20th and the 21st centuries. And this inquiry is valuable not just for the history of transitions and the restoration of a democratic state, but for the promise of Poland as a new center of European culture, as Western Europe looks increasingly to the needs of Central and Eastern Europe. We started Humanity in Action Poland 7 years ago under the guidance of EBZ and the German Humanity in Action Germany, and with the generous support of EBZ. This expansion has stretched our boundaries and horizons in numerous ways, and challenging ways, and mainly in regard to diversity issues. This requires a short explanation. Among the many countries that are part of Humanity in Action, Poland today has the least ethnic, religious, and racial diversity. Before the Second World War, it had the most diverse. Thus, the temptation to throw ourselves back and to concentrate on the disastrous history of the war years, to grapple with the so-called vanished limb of diversity, particularly in regard to Polish Jewry. But thanks to the insightful and creative programmatic work of Monica and Magda, that past is only one substantial part of the subjects they take on. Thus, the fellows explore how Poland has resisted and recovered from totalitarian regimes, how it strengthened its democratic processes, how it battles to reduce discrimination against the disabled and gays, how it organizes social campaigns, and how it impresses the Polish voice upon the European and transatlantic discourse. Our dear friend Konstanty Gebert, who is here tonight, has said that Poland has too much history to absorb. And I'm sure he's right. But I'm afraid, as an historian, I can't resist the temptation to think first in historical terms. Thus, I wish to speak about two people who can illuminate our present challenges. Jan Karski, the Polish resistance fighter and illustrious professor of international affairs at Georgetown University in Washington, and Stefan Zweig, still widely read in Germany and Austria, as a significant novelist, dramatist, and biographer, but unfortunately less known in America. A few years ago, Claude Lanzmann published his autobiography, The Patagonian Hare. Lanzmann is best known for making the film Shoah, and I must say having an affair with Simone de Beauvoir. The book is fascinating, long, often very, very funny, insightful, and a great example of his irrepressible narcissism. In the climactic portion about making Shoah, Lanzmann mentioned that he did 3 interviews with Jan Karski that were not in the film, Shoah. Having read The Secret State by Karski, Karski's remarkable book, published in 1944, I was eager to see these clips on YouTube. 2 segments are particularly moving and historically informative. The Polish underground movement to which Karski belonged sent him to England and the United States in 1942 and 1943. His mission was to give firsthand accounts of the resistance in Poland to the German occupation and to generate confidence in a post-war democratic Poland, the so-called secret state in the making. He was also tasked with informing officials and various leaders in England and the U.S. about the fate of Polish Jewry. Thus, Karski, a young Catholic, was surreptitiously brought into the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942, and in the uniform of a guard, also to Izvestia, and not, as you will see in the clip coming, to Belzec. But Izbetsia, which I probably mispronounce, was a transit camp that employed gas to kill Jews. In the interview that you're going to see, Karski describes his meeting with President Roosevelt in the White House in 1943, one that was arranged by the Polish ambassador to the United States. The context is pretty clear. Karski was to bring firsthand testimony to the president to solicit his support for protecting Polish democratic interests against the Germans, as well as pressures internal and external from communist forces. The context for the second interview, which we will not have time to see, is a more complicated one. Karski, in the second one, described his meetings with Shmuel Zygelbaum in a London office. And Zygelbaum was a member of the Polish National Council and the Bund, a Jewish political party with socialist leanings that was active in pre-war Poland. So we're going to watch this YouTube video of Karski describing his meeting with Roosevelt.
Okay. Secretary leads me to his office. I see Roosevelt. He looked like a world leader.
Like a world leader?
World leader, yes. As a matter of fact, he struck me. He was more than the President of the United States. His formulations, his gestures. He did consider himself a world leader. He sits behind his desk. Behind him, of course, all American flags. You know, very impressive, the whole wall covered by them. Very high chair. Grand Seigneur. Because I was warned he will not get up when he would shake your hand. He's crippled. He shakes hand. Please sit down, Mr. Ambassador. Says, Mr. Karski, I know about you. I have been informed about your great work, contribution to the Allied cause. I am sure that you would like me to be informed about things in Poland, please. Now, realize this, I had it throughout my entire mission. For me, the Jewish problem was not the only problem. For me, the key problem was Poland. Curzon Line, Soviet demands, communists in the underground movement, fear of the Polish nation, what is going to happen to Poland. This was the emphasis.
Of your mission.
Oh, yes, of my mission, of course, and my concern, naturally. I speak to the president in those terms. Expectations, fears among the leaders. All hope, Mr. President, has been placed by the Polish nations in the hands of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
You said this?
Oh,
yes. In proper words?
Oh, yes, in the same words. Mm-hmm. Not the president. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He says, I describe thinking how much time I have. He says, then I come to the Jewish problem. Mr. President, I have also a mission. Mr. President, before having left Poland, I was charged with this mission by the most important Jewish leaders, They organized for me 2 visits in the ghetto. I saw extermination camp. The name is Belzec, B-E-L-Z-E-C. Mr. President, the situation is horrible. The point is, without the outside help, the Jews will perish in Poland. He entered. I remember every second of this conversation. The Allied nations...
What did he answer specifically?
Nothing. He enters the picture now. Nothing.
This was the end of your report?
Yes.
Nothing. It came at the end, the Jewish...
I never had a chance. So now his answer. The Allied nations are going to win this war. No more wars. Justice will be done. Your country will be alive again, more prosperous than before. Criminals will be punished. The United States will not abandon your country. As a matter of fact, now he says, Poland, as recompensation, will receive East Prussia, or a part of East Prussia. No more corridor. And now to the ambassador. Mr. Ambassador, what do you think about? Of course, Mr. Ambassador loves it, only he wants all of
East Prussia, not part of East Prussia.
Short conversation over there. Then, when you return to Poland, you will tell your Polish leaders, this country will never fail them. They have a friend in the President of the United States. And now, he does ask me questions, oh yes, underground movement. Do you know what question he asked me? Do I understand correctly, young man, that before the war, Poland was essentially an agricultural country? Yes, Mr. President, it was so. Well, now, what we understand in the Russian campaign, Germans had to use tremendous amount of horses. Did they take those horses from Poland? Because with your agricultural economy, you need horses. Mr. President, yes. He asked me other questions. I had no chance except my initial statement to tell you, Mr. President, listen to me. Well, you don't speak to the President of the United States. No Jewish problem was mentioned until the end of the conversation, which lasted 1 hour 20 minutes.
But excuse me to insist, but it is my theme. About the Jews, did he ask specific questions?
No.
No one?
No. Not a single one.
Not a single one?
Not a single one.
How do
what
you...
I said only on my initiative as an opening statement when he asked me, I presume you want to pass certain information, bring attention.
Okay, you gave everything on the Jews at the end.
General terms, yes. I thought again.
You didn't ask one specific question.
Not a single one.
And how do you explain this?
I don't.
So, after watching the interview about Roosevelt, and then the one about Ziegelblum, I was struck by the disparities in personality and power between these two men, and of Karski's radically different reaction to them. They personify opposite extremes of authority and emotion. The president was cool, commanding, immobile due to his paralyzed legs, and in total command of the conversation and seemingly in control of the fate of the Polish democratic state. And Karski, as you can see, was in awe of the president's power and of his stunningly aware of the constrained and inflexible borders of the president's interest in Poland and in Polish Jewry. The messenger clearly understood that he would not propel the president to supportive action for the Polish resistance or the Polish democratic state or for Polish Jews. Whereas the interview, which fortunately you didn't see, Karski describes Zingelblum's reaction in a totally different way. Zingelblum was overcome by emotion, as Karski talked about what he had seen in Poland. Zingelblum was agitated. He was distraught by his helplessness. He was nearly hysterical and despairing of finding ways to inform the world and those in power of what was happening to Polish Jews. In this case, Karski knew that Zingelblum completely understood the searing news from Poland about massive destruction. A few weeks later, Zingelblum spoke passionately on the BBC, and he said, it will actually be a shame to go on living to belong to the human race if steps are not taken to halt the greatest crime in human history. In May 1943, Zingelblum committed suicide after once more asking in a final note that the world take action. In 1944, Karski published his first book, The Secret State. It was written for an American audience in compelling detail about his history as a young, little-known resistance fighter, his visits to England and the U.S., his meeting with the president and leaders of the Jewish community in the West, and his fervent hope for the reestablishment of a Polish democratic state. They were unfulfilled. He did not return to Poland, but instead became a professor in Washington and an expert on communism and international relations. And according to his interview with Lanzmann, he never spoke for the next 40 years about the Holocaust. This courageous man could not do it. He couldn't talk about it. He had no more messages to share about what happened. He kept his grief to himself, and in a certain sense, this powerful history, formed by a resistance fighter, Democrat, forthright observer, and bold messenger, is one of silence, a silence that reverberates with profound meaning and poignancy. Stefan Zweig embodies another kind of silence that is equally powerful and sad. In 1941, he was close to completing an expansive semi-autobiographical work, The World Before Yesterday. And again, like Karski, he wrote parts of the work as a foreigner in the United States. Unlike Karski, however, Zweig drew upon his literary skills as a famous European author of remarkable productivity, quality, and critical success with translations in over 30 languages. He was at one point the best-selling author in all of Europe. His family roots were in Galicia, a part of Poland that was taken over by the Habsburgs in the late 18th century. And Zweig's family escaped the densely populated and insular Galician Jewish world, and he migrated to the thriving Austrian capital. His father prospered as a businessman, enabling his son to grow up in secure affluence to shun the family business for a literary career. Zweig joined the Viennese and European liberal intelligentsia, establishing close friendships with great figures such as Sigmund Freud and Paul Valéry and Richard Strauss and James Joyce and Toscanini and many others. As an established writer, he enriched the vibrant, audacious cosmopolitan Viennese society that transformed art and music and science and theater and literature in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Until the beginning of the First World War, he felt that he lived at the center of creativity and freedom. The World Before Yesterday is a powerful evocation of thwarted aspirations for the Europe of his youth, regret for the lost hope of a liberal, democratic, and a harmonious Europe, and a furious indictment of dictatorial and mass violence. The work, imbued with a modesty that Landsman could never even dream of, describes Zweig's pre-World War I hopes as a pacifist for united, peaceful, inclusive European society. They failed. First through the nationalistic destruction of the First World War, and then the fall of the Habsburg Empire, and the ensuing years of economic chaos after the conflict ended. And when Europe seemed to return to normalcy in the 20s, Zweig reignited his dream for a peaceful future and a European culture. Hitler shattered any such possibilities starting in the early 1930s. Zweig's books were burned and then banned in Germany. In 1934, Austria was no longer safe for him, so he emigrated to England. Within a few years, his writings were banned in every country that Germany conquered, and his broad circle of intellects and Democrats were in flight. While he had voluntarily left for England in the mid-1930s with the Anschluss, Zweig lost his citizenship and became a refugee, stripped of his nationality, culture, and home. In Bath, England, on September 1st, 1939, he sought to obtain a marriage license to marry for a second time. He went to the registry office to sign papers. Just then, he wrote, it must have been 11 o'clock in the morning, the door to the next room flew open. A young official burst in, getting into his coat while walking. The Germans have invaded Poland. This is war, he shouted into the quiet room. The word fell like a hammer blow upon my heart, Zweig wrote. As an Austrian by birth, he knew he would immediately become an enemy alien in England. Again, I was aware, he wrote, that the past was done for. Work achieved was in ruins. Europe, our home to which we had dedicated ourselves, had suffered a destruction that would extend far beyond our life. Something new, a new world began. But how many hells, how many purgatories had to be crossed before it could be reached? Zweig had spent the years since leaving Austria and England, the U.S., and finally in Brazil. It was there that he and his wife jointly committed suicide in 1942. In the final passages of The World Before Yesterday, he wrote of shadows, first watching his own as he walked down a sunny street in London right after England declared war on Germany, and then the gloomy shadow of the First World War, which he thought might suffuse his autobiography. But, he wrote, after all, shadows themselves are born of light, and only he who has experienced dawn and dusk, war and peace, ascent and decline, only he has lived, truly. I believe that being in Poland today, a country that has gone through too many purgatories and hells, affirms the fervent democratic beliefs of both Karski and Zweig. Although pessimism and despair drove Zweig to suicide, the act did not invalidate his hopes for a peaceful and a humane European existence. Karski built a new life in America and waited for the fall of the communist regime. There is probably too much history in Poland to digest, as Gabert says. But it's only by bringing that history into the present and searching for knowledge, meaning, and idealistic humanistic beliefs that we can meet our responsibilities to the present and to the future. And might I say, when I speak of we, I mean to speak principally to humanity in action. We do not, as individuals or as a collectivity, have the right to be silent. We seek to understand the present through the past, and at this conference and through the annual Polish Humanity in Action programs, we seek to gain greater exposure to an understanding of the brilliant intellectual tradition of historical research that belongs to Poland. We seek to encounter great figures from the past, such as Karski and Zweig, who inform us about their lives and times that still deeply affect the boundaries of our challenges, needs, and hopes in Europe and the United States. We seek to draw wisdom and courage from their courage and values. Close to the end of his life, Zweig wrote, "Our greatest debt of gratitude is to those in these inhuman times confirm the human in us, who encourage us not to abandon our unique and imperishable possession, our innermost self. One who brings us close to that imperishable possession is the great Polish poet Milosz. His Polish voice, truly a universal voice, which meshes into the voices of Karski and of Zweig, illuminates our presence in Warsaw today and the painful challenges of past and present that we assume. Still, one more year of preparation. Tomorrow, at the latest, I will start work on a great book in which my country will appear as it really was. The sun will rise over the wise and wicked. Springs and autumns will unerringly return. In a wet thicket, a thrush will build his nest lined with clay, and foxes will learn their foxy natures. And that will be the subject with the denda. Thus armies running across frozen plains, shouting a curse in a many-voiced chorus, and the cannon of a tank growing immense at the corner of a street, the ride at dusk into a camp with watchtowers and barbed wire. No, it won't happen tomorrow, in 5 or 10 years. I still think too much about the mothers and ask, what is man born of women? He curls himself up and protects his head. While he is kicked by heavy boots, on fire and running, he burns with bright flame. A bulldozer sweeps him into a clay pit. Her child, embracing a teddy bear, conceived in ecstasy. I haven't learned yet to speak as I should, calmly. Thank you.